more than thing to remember about tennis. Right. So, apologies for those of you who are online. We've been having all sorts of sound problems, but at least we're going to be able to record something. What we have talked about so far is extended static innovation, which you should think about. There's the explanation in my notes, blah, blah, blah. And we're now talking about the intertextuality of Mariana. So, yes, so there's, this is classically medieval, you might say it's, whether it's late medieval or Renaissance, it doesn't really matter, but it's looking sort of significantly back in history at a previous period, which is in some sense romanticized. Okay, so we've got this idea that the complete works of Shakespeare is a sort of second Bible akin to nature, and so it was an obvious place to go for inspiration. And Tennyson, we know, was very, very knowledgeable about English Renaissance drama. So who is Mariana waiting for in Mariana or in Measure for Measure? Angelo, yes. Angelo, this line, Mariana, in the Moated Grange, was taken directly from there. Why is this ironic? Why is the poem and its relationship with Measure for Measure ironic? Yeah, I mean, Angelo is wholly unworthy of this woman. She's sort of very nice, very reasonable, and very decent, and he is awful. Yes, she does. We know from reading Measure for Measure, if we have, that she will end up, he will be forced into marrying her by the Duke, and she will end up married and with very few prospects of being happy from being married. So the whole situation is rather ironic, in that, she wants what she doesn't have, but what she doesn't have is not that something that is actually going to make her happy. This man is a complete idiot. So, when she does get out of her magic grain, she's just going to be trapped in a new sort of way. So, that idea of, where have we seen that idea of sort of women waiting for men to make a move before? Okay. So a lot of the action in private prisons is women waiting for men to come and impress them or whatever. And that idea of women passively waiting is sort of part of the frustration of the period. So, Mariana can also be seen as a response to the story of Margaret in Book One of Wordsworth's The Excursion. Book One was published in 1814. So, anybody any idea about Margaret, The Excursion? Don't. It's really boring. Basically, Margaret and her family have been destroyed by poverty, and her husband goes off to war, disappears, and she's waiting for him to come back. And her elder child leaves to work on a farm, and her younger child dies. It's fine. Dispirited by years of waiting for her husband's return, Margaret becomes abstracted and inconsolate. The cottage and the garden decay by neglect, and she dies, which is about the most exciting thing that happens in the story. While Wordsworth's story is full of pathetic fallacy with the passing of the seasons, and the steady deterioration of the cottage, reflecting Margaret's decline, his poem is painfully long. Yeah, I mean, yes, you get a feeling of what it must be like waiting for something to happen, reading Book One of The Excursion, but please. People's lives are too short these days. You know, we have better things to do than this endless process of Wordsworth being Wordsworth. So, as you know, I am not impartial about Wordsworth, and I'm not a fan. It is interesting that Mariana's fate to have been secluded from the world in some distant farmhouse is exactly the same house. Where have we seen this idea of a woman being secluded from the world in some distant farmhouse? So, we haven't seen Jane. In the future, you know nothing about Jane until next week. No, Pride and Prejudice. In Pride and Prejudice, they discuss tangentially, not directly, the different options of what can happen to Lydia if she doesn't manage to get married to Wickham. And, you know, one of them could be for her to go on to the town, so become a prostitute. One of them could be, another option is to have her basically, if there's a family embarrassment, and this is awful, these people are awful in many senses, there's some member of the family is somehow embarrassing, then you pay somebody to keep them in a farmhouse a long way away from civilization so you don't have to see them. Does that make any sense in terms of Jane Austen's biography? She had a disabled brother who this happened to, which is disgraceful, different times, basically. That is sort of a real option. That's very much what happens in A Woman Killed by Kindness, yeah? Which is one of the things that you might have sort of seen last year. There is an unfaithful wife in this Jacobean domestic tragedy, and the husband basically just sends her to live in a remote farmhouse where she dies of regret. Fun story. That's sort of interesting because the idea of this type of sequestering, as we might call it, is for the person basically to die socially. They no longer have focus of attention. You can forget about them. And here, of course, what Tennyson is doing is bringing a big spotlight onto the person. You know, so that's taking things the other way around, if you like. Mariana can also be compared with, now we need your expertise, in Great Expectations. Miss Havisham. Miss Havisham, right. Where you have another sort of woman who's spends her life with her house falling around her while she's waiting for somebody, etc. So there's lots of waiting going on. All of these words can be taken as a critical comment on the passivity expected of 19th century women. Generally speaking, in terms of what I was saying about not being too nasty about the Victorians, most of the poets have much, much more liberal ideas than society, well, poets and novelists, etc., etc. So the attitudes being shown by writers about social and other, you wouldn't, you know, it does suggest that there is a current in society which is much, much more progressive and liberal. So whether that's the mayor of Casterbridge. No points in the trivia quiz. Thomas Hardy. Or whether it's Ruth by Mrs. Gaskell, Elizabeth Gaskell. Or the way that women are presented in the different Bronte things, etc., etc. Certainly, George Eliot's women are very, very sympathetically portrayed. But it's not just the women, both men and women. The poetry of Dante Gabriel Rossetti, the brother of Christina Rossetti, there's a very sort of sympathetic view of the difficult situation of women. He wasn't a very good husband, but he was sort of sympathetic about the plight of women in society. And, I mean, when we, in 2 weeks' time, we'll work with it, is when we get to Robert Browning, we'll see that very, very much. A very sort of serious attempt to understand women's situation in the stock context. So, yeah, not all Victorians. How does the poem symbolize... This is not very well written. How does the poem symbolize... Oh, sorry, right, okay. Right, I'm reading it wrong. How does the symbolism of the poem work? How does the symbolism function in this poem?
Because the character doesn't evolve, this is something of the time, maybe it's better as a revolution that reflects an inner
thought. Okay, so she's trapped in a process of stasis. Is everything else in stasis?
No.
Well, how could we describe in a sort of sophisticated way the situation for everything else?
Everything is
foreign,
yes.
Right, but that's not sophisticated. I want really sophisticated. Right. But what's the word we want? No? Entropy.
Entropy.
Entropy. Yeah. So, we have this process of stasis in her situation combined with entropy. So, there's very much a sort of recognition that, and this may be more of an English thing than a Spanish thing, but if you leave some structure or anything as well in England, because of the amount of rain and the amount of greenery, etc., things very, very quickly get reconquered by nature. And you could probably leave something in somewhere like Cayenne or somewhere like that for quite a long time, and it's not going to be eroded and reconquered by nature as quickly. But if we understand order and civilization as this constant process of having to clean and change and cut back the natural growth and all these types of things, that's very much the sort of what's being suggested here. So both in the case of Margaret, in the excursion and here, what we have is somebody who stopped bothering. And so it's like, you know, not passing them on the vacuum cleaner or something. It's all just slowly entropying. The order of the human constructed world is forged and maintained by conscious endeavor. When human ordering activity ceases, things fall apart. So what signs of entropy are there in the poem? What signs of entropy do we have in the poem? Right, so we have, can you be more specific? Right, so in terms of, we have the dilapidated sheds, yeah, they're directly falling apart. The decomposing moss, which is blackened and is invading the flower beds. The rust, yeah. The weeds, and the wear on the thatch. Do you understand thatch? In Britain, it's still relatively common in the countryside to see houses with roofs that are made of straw, and that's thatch. That's where we get the word thatcher from. Thatcher is somebody who makes those roofs originally. The gnarling of the poplar. So the poplar has had some type of insect or bacterial attack, and you know when you have these sort of distorted, tumorous shapes on the tree, that's there. The mold on the waistcoat, and the dust, the thick moated sunbeams, etc. The great natural symbols of life are antagonistic in this poem. For example, what symbols of life do we have in nature? I suppose it could be, but I wasn't talking about that. Right, so tree, we have the Anglo family tree, the tree of life, all of that sort of thing. The tree is intrusive, you know, it's invading that space. Anything else? What other symbol of life do we have?
Nature itself,
there is outside the house. Right, but can we be specific about particular symbols of life?
The sun
is loathsome, we're told. Yes, hateful. And also the other thing is wind. You know, wind is related to breath, is related to sikhe, all of these types of things. Wind tends to also be considered the life force. And all of those things are hostile, and all of those things are, in a Jungian sense, masculine. What is the specific symbolism of the poplar? What's a poplar? It's animal. Remember the animal. So why is the poplar symbolic? Is it deciduous? I think so, yeah. Yeah, it could be. It could be an element of being deciduous. But deciduousness suggests regeneration as well as shedding of leaves and things. So a tree can denote a cosmic life force, but there may also be a reference to Oenone. Any idea who Oenone is? Probably Oenone in Spanish. Oenone? Okay. According to Ovid, Paris was in love with Oenone, and Paris promised Oenone that he would love her until the river, that they were doing the river, Xanthus flowed backwards, and then sort of 2 days later he saw Helen and went off with Helen. And so there is this it's a symbol of a bound of love in that sort of sense. Poplar trees can also symbolize fertility and a broken vine, so in that case the poplar in its nature can be considered a phallic symbol, possibly representing a sort of hand of a clock or a sundial, since it's telling the time of day by the shadow cast up along the bed. I don't really see how that works. How a poplar, some distance away, would cast it. Maybe the special windows or something. Homer's name for the poplar was Acheros, which implies a connection with death, because the river Acheron flowed through Hades. This idea is reinforced in Virgil, where white poplars grow by the river of Acheron. That's this sort of association with living death, with people who are in a transitional state. And of course, those types of transitional states are a situation of being alive in death, etc., can be described as limbo, yes. And these types of boundary blurring situations are uncanny. Right? So all of these types of references, this type of sort of weird psychology can be seen again in the incorporation of Gothic sensibilities into later poetry. And it probably will never happen, but I'm always waiting for Ruthie Quinathinta to write a, to give you an essay question, which is discuss how the aesthetics of the Gothicism influenced two or three works of your choice that you've studied this time. And, you know, you can, there's a lot of room for you to play with that. So, it may happen one day. Who knows? Yeah. I've given them the idea, they can do what they like. How does Tennyson use personification? But directly we're told that the broken sheds look sad and strange. So, you know, buildings are not sad. The lonely, it's called a lonely motive grange. The building is being personified if you're calling it lonely. It's not, buildings are not lonely. And the poplar shakes, which might suggest fear, trembling, in that sort of sense. In stanza three, the morning is grey-eyed. Yeah? Grey-eyed suggests, a face, if you like. In stanza four, the blackened waters slept. Yeah, water doesn't actually sleep. In stanza four, in the 1830 version, the poplar did mark the level wastes. One meaning of to mark could be to observe. Okay? And in stanza seven, the sun has a western bower. So the sun has a place of rest. Of course, that's being contrasted, you know, the sun rests at night, according to this personification. That's being contrasted with the idea that Mariana doesn't. Yeah, she's awake or not. What is the role of nature in the poem?
It's remembering the feelings of...
Which is called... Right. So, we have pathetic fallacy as a capacity to only see reality subjectively. The attribution of one's emotions and psychological states to the natural world. The fecundity of the landscape is ironically a reminder of what she does not have. The poem describes physical and psychological stasis and underlying decay in a context of melancholy isolation. Everything is giving way to a more primitive force of nature, or degenerating into lower forms of matter. Classic entropy. At the same time, the movement and the sounds of activity of the natural world around, so the bats splitting, the sun setting, the movement of the sound, the rooster crowing, the wind blowing, the tree swaying, the moon shining, the hinges creaking, seem at odds with her stasis and thus emphasize it. See if I can speak English today. And that's combined with all sorts of weird verbal relationships and things, which probably are less obvious for you. But there is quite a lot of situations where you're sort of having to rethink about the meaning of words and how they're being used. So while nature goes about its routine, the normal housekeeping and maintenance tasks are not being performed. This is emphasized by the unusual use of weeded. Now, to weed normally is a transitive verb. For taking weeds out or something. When here, when he's talking about the weeded roof, I think it is the weeded thatch, it means that weeds are growing in it. So there is the connotation of the idea of taking the weeds out and weeded, and of course nobody's doing that. So that's making you think about what's not being done. How is the wind described? How is the wind described?
It says,
so we have wild winds.
in stanza 5. Any more? In stanza 3, we have cold winds. And also in stanza 5, we have shrill winds. And in stanza 7, we have wooing winds. Do you understand wooing? Yeah. Cortejando, sort of idea, yes. So there is perhaps irony in the repeated reference to the wind, because in Latin, Greek, and Hebrew, wind was associated with breath and therefore with being alive. Certainly to the extent that we associate the wind with change, the winds of change is a classic phrase, its presence is ironic in the context of Marianne's thesis. How does Tennyson use tonality to create mood? Right. So, lots of greys and blacks. They're tones rather than colours. So we have the blackest moss, where the thickest dark did trace the sky, the dark fen, the grey-eyed morn, blackened water, and the rounding grey. This can be linked to the alternative meaning of dreary, which is colourless. Okay? So the idea of what is without colour is also depressing. How does the poem seem uncanny? Okay, so we have this idea of ghosts, and the idea of that this woman's life has been halted in a particular moment in the past. Anything else? Right. We also have the fact that this is a non-story with no climax. Yeah, I mean, we would expect this description, and then at the end she dies, or Angela turns up, or something happens, but it's just a description of a situation, and that is to some extent uncanny, especially as we begin to be fed. We begin to have a sense of novels. Yeah? So would be quite surprising in prose fiction. So there's no climax. Of course, pathetic fallacy itself is uncanny. Other Gothic elements include the references to bats. Yeah, just think of the Sleep of Reason breeds monsters. A drawing by Goya. Sueño de la razón.
Yes.
Genera monstruos. Bats. Yeah, so bats. Not just Batman, but bats have this general idea of being Gothic. A trance. Yeah. A trance, which is a state of semi-consciousness, is Gothic. Owls. Also in the Sueño de la razón. There are owls. Shadows, of course. Creaking doors. Shrieks. Disembodied voices, footsteps, and faces. Okay, so basically ghosts. Sounds are distorted and misplaced. The fact that the cock and the blue fly sing is weird. Yeah? We don't normally talk about a cock singing. Cock crows as it sing. And certainly we don't have the idea that flies sing when they buzz. By the same token, we would expect the mouse to squeak. But instead of squeaking, it shrieks. Yeah? Shriek implies fear. Yeah, so it's unsettling because of the fear involved. We would associate the verb to crow, as I said, with cocks, but the owl crows. When we talk about owls, we talk about an owl hooting. So to say the owl crows is like, that's weird. Likewise, Tennyson unsettles us with unexpected collocations. In the first line, we would expect flower pots, but not flower plots. So again, by changing the words associations and the collocations, he's making us think about what words actually mean. And a clinking latch is usually unlifted. It's usually uplifted, connoting inspiration and hope, rather than unlifted, which is emphasizing its static situation. Similarly, we would expect the term night owl, but we don't get night owl, we get night fowl. Okay? Which of course has the homophone of foul and foul, and things most foul, blah, 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 is a very Gothic concept. We have the confusion between the verb to crow and of course the noun to crow. And crows, you are becoming experts on Edgar Poe, very soon. Crows and ravens, the whole Corvus family are very Gothic. Blah, blah, blah. Notice how the enjambment is used to create unusual semantic effects. The shadow of the poplar fell upon her head, across her brow. There's a jarring process in that enjambment. Significantly, it is the shadow that visits her bed instead of the long-awaited lover. And of course, the shadow is another word for a ghost. Notice Tennyson's use of a feminine ending, dreary, a weary, feminine endings, to describe a woman who wants a feminine ending. How does Tennyson treat time in this poem? Cyclical, good. Anything else?
The idea that time is passing and it's loose.
Right. How is time passing? Right. But how is it passing? Very slowly. Painfully slowly. Yeah? Nothing has happened. Time is slowed down to a level of imperceptible change. We might link this to Tennyson's interest in geology. Yeah, Tennyson is very interested in geology. Of course, probably I think it's quite difficult for us to realize quite how serious the blow delivered to Christianity from geology was. But, I mean, I imagine there must be about 3 Christians in the world today who actually believe that the world was created 6,000 years ago on a Tuesday, I think it's the 20th of October. But everybody basically before Lyell, the whole idea of geology was demonstrated to anyone who had a minimal level of scientific understanding, believed that the idea of the 6,000 year history of the world. Well, I suppose it's not creationists who believe that, because they believe that there were people when there were dinosaurs and stuff like that. But most educated people. If you like Christianity, it's very cleverly incorporated that, and it's now not a problem at all. But it was a huge problem at this time, and really very, very unsettling for people, the fact that this basic idea in the Bible is just wrong. Yeah? There's no sort of two ways about it. Of course, we're probably more aware of Darwinism, because Darwinism sort of basically makes God irrelevant. But the advent of geology was also very, very important in the sense, of course, it was earlier. So the impression of slowing down can be linked to the key word in the refrain, weary. Time is so slow in stanza 3 that the moss creeps. Yeah, I mean, you could say that's sort of a fast image, but you know when you have delayed photography and you see plants growing, There's that idea, even obviously this is long before delay action photography, but there's this idea that time is moving so slowly that you can see the blinds actually spreading, again, which again, as I say, you could understand as time moving so quickly, you can see that, but time is distorted, which is important. As a result of the deceleration of time, in her less anguished moments, Mariana is filled with such boredom that she notices the most trivial things. The buzzing of a fly, the chirping of sparrows, the slow ticking of the clock, and the creaking of the door. Now, none of these are sounds which sort of connect you with life. They're all sort of sounds which are just a bit annoying. And that is the nature of these are the small, distant sounds, emphasizes the fact that basically there is an absolute level of silence. Moreover, night and day, night is down to two, day is down to three, and dawn is down to two, and dusk, eve in stanza two, provoke the same reaction in her despondency. So we have the passing of the day, I mean, and most of us have times in the day when we actually prefer. She is noticing the time, the changes in the time of the day have been noticed. She just doesn't care. And she's in this sort of state of depression where there's no real distinction between day and night. Night is not the time when she sleeps, if she sleeps at all. She could not look on the sweet heaven either at morn or eventide. So, there's this idea of rejecting nature and the sky and all these types of things at all times of day. The dislocation of time that Mariana experiences is carried over into her actions. She only opens her curtains at night time. How does Tennyson use unconventional tenses? Tenses. Grammatical tenses. Weary is such a weird word. We would say weary rather than a weary. It's archaic, but I'm not sure it's an unconventional tense as such. Really.
Okay, but it's like the
I wasn't really referring to that. No. T.S. Eliot pointed out that the blue fly sung in the pen. It should be sang in the pen. The fact that it's a perfect tense suggests that it's sort of deadened. It's like perfect tense is sort of stasis, if you know what I mean. It's just a past participle. So the insect is just sort of eternally trapped in this pane of glass, in this house. Like Mariana, it is imprisoned in the Grange. So the fly and Mariana are ultimately victims of this whole situation. Similarly, the crow sung out. Again, it should be the crow sang out. So we're using the same sort of thing. Notice that the clock crows an hour before dawn, reputedly the darkest hour. Again, the cock crowing in the dark suggests the disruption of circadian cycles. How does Tennyson use homophony to generate parallel images and ideas? Homophony. Okay, for example, as we saw, Tennyson wrote Night Fowl instead of Night Owl to introduce the connotation of fowl, most foul. Do you find any other examples of suggestive homophony or homonymy? Right, we have the idea that Mark can be an observer or just be an ethos. Mariana is trapped within a plot. Yeah, in the same way that Mariana in Measure for Measure is trapped within a plot. One of them is trapped within a trama, the other is trapped within a area of land. But they're both trapped in the plot. The knots imply constriction and also foreshadow the gnarling in the poplar. Gnarled means knotted. Moreover, knots foreshadow he cometh not. Shed, the sheds connotes the verb shed, implying entropy. Worn is a homophone of warm. Yazo, as in adventir. The wooing wind simply refers to the sound made by the wind, but it reminds us of her lover's non-wooing. Yeah? The wind is not trying to cortejarla. The wind is just going, yeah, but it's a reminder of that. Moated grains and thick moated sunbeams are linked by homophony. The window being described as a pain makes us think of pain, yeah, her psychological pain. The homonym of flat, meaning emotionless, and it links back to dreary. Okay? The homonym of low means depressed, linked back to dreary. The homophone of waste in stanza 4 plays on the other meaning of waste. The wind's cell implies that Marianne's own home is a confinement. She's confined in her like a prison cell. A thwart simply means a cross, but to thwart means to frustrate, so it makes you think about it. So there's a lot of just playing with the sounds of words to make us think of more things than poetry there. And Tennyson is very, very good at that. As I say, sometimes what he says at a philosophical level or whatever can be a bit trite, is a bit light, shall we say. But he is very good with sounds. How does Tennyson use euphony? Nice sounds. Could be to create contrast, but this is more to do with things like alliteration and above all assonance. There's a huge amount of assonance in this poem. When we say the lonely moated grange, yeah, that repetition in the second book. Stress syllables of a diphthong, lonely motive, very, yeah, so, weeds and weeded and warm, unlifted was the clinking latch, yeah, unlifted was the clinking, clinking latch, this partial, alliteration, crusted and rusted, that's a term in tunnel. We have 5 minutes. So now it's your turn. Compare and contrast Mariana and the Lady of Shalott. The tower, yes. Any other phallic symbols in the Lady of Shalott? Lancelot's bugle is meant to be phallic. I'm not sure how that works, but it is meant to be. Poems chiefly lyrical and poems, 1932, included more than a dozen lady poems. These are two examples. So they're both very much part of this very big focus of the female experience. And I mean, it's fascinating what we consider the female experience rather than just a human experience, especially in the light of In Memoriam, because In Memoriam was first published anonymously, and one of the first reviewers said that it was clearly written by a woman who had lost her lover, and effectively that's sort of what's happened. It's not a woman, but that sensitivity to the female experience, I think, is again probably something that Tennyson wasn't fully aware of, that's at play here. He's clearly very, very interested in that kind of experience. So, in that sense, they're both participating in the debate about the condition of women. A topic that filled pages of periodicals in the years immediately before and during the lady poem's composition. Alexander Pope, bless him, had declared that most women have no character at all. This was no longer a tenable position for the early Victorians. Okay, so this reminds me of when we were in Morocco and a Moroccan gentleman told me and my wife, who was not very happy, that all men are individuals, but all women are basically the same. So my wife was unimpressed at this comment. I was more amused, she was more upset. But anyway, so I mean, again, it's I think healthy for us to remember that a lot of sort of these weird misogynist attitudes, actually we don't have to go very, very far back in our history to find them as well. One of the things that comes up in Goblin Market is there was a Victorian idea that having sex with a virgin could cure things like syphilis, which of course was a disaster because that just meant that sexually transmitted diseases were just more spread. But there is that myth exists in Southern Africa at the moment with AIDS. The idea of having sex with a virgin is a way of curing AIDS. And sometimes that can be sort of put across in a rather sort of superior, if not directly racist way. But it's only a century earlier, or a little bit more than a century earlier, that those ideas were happening in the metropolis of Europe, London. So we're not actually that much more advanced and that much more politically correct. If you talk to very young people, and I spent quite a lot of time with people who are sort of 18, 19 in my university, they're not really aware of the position of women, for example, with Paquito. It's just sort of unthinkable for them. And, it's unthinkable for you, but it's in my lifetime. That's another question. So, Hallam encouraged Alfred to look for female characters beyond Shakespeare in medieval romance. Both our poems deal with female passivity, as you said. Both include phallic symbols, as you said. Both include pathetic fallacy.
She decides to do something even if it means punishment and death.
Yes, I think that in one case the passage is giving very good reason to people that it's
Yes.
She has no future about she decides.
But I mean, she could not be, she had to do something because the lady is also afraid of this possible curse that's going to go over. Yeah, but she decides to do something. So that's quite distinctive. Like,
No, I mean, I think I tend to relate that to the idea of Karl Marx, the philosophers who only interpreted the world and the point is to change it. It's hugely comfortable just to be an observer of what's happening in the world. You get, I mean, for us, I think the Lady of Shalott's window and her tapestry, etc., has a lot to do with television. And so it's very easy just to be sort of observing the world, forming theories about the world, but not actually participating in the world. And definitely, yeah. And of course, yeah, there's a feeling that an artist has to have a certain distance from the world, but if ultimately, you know, if you're just a commentator, you're not actually really participating in life. Of course, participating in life necessarily means participating in the process towards death. In the Lady of Shalott's case, more quickly, in any case. Another difference is that the Lady of Shalott is initially contented. Yeah, she's sort of singing, relatively happy, whereas Mariana is permanently depressed. A little bit like the inversion of the whole Emily trope in The Knight's Tale. Because what you actually have is, I mean, all of the three things tend to be, I think, a little bit the idea that a large part of being in love is what you project onto the other person, but the other person maybe not even knowing. So she has, you know, she's got this idea of Lancelot. And at the end of the poem, the idea is, oh, she has a pretty face. Which is so
inappropriate.
I mean, the same thing with Angela. Yeah? This woman has developed a whole world around Angela, which has nothing to do with the person involved, really. I mean, he's not worth it. Yes. Yeah, well, there's also